Beyond Pistons, your daily Detroit Pistons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello and welcome to the Locked On Pistons podcast. This is your host, Matt Shook, and this is the episode for Friday, January 12th. The Pistons are looking for a win in the Windy City, but you can follow me on Twitter at Matt_Shook, S-C-H-O-C-H, another underscore after that. Follow us on Locked On Pistons Twitter account as well, and check out the Facebook page, which is titled Locked On Pistons-Matt Shook. But today, we'll be looking ahead to Saturday night's game against the Chicago Bulls here in Chicago, where I taped the podcast from. I've got an update on Andre Drummond's plight of becoming an All-Star, and we got an interview with Nathan Bierman, a Detroit sports historian, with a look at the early days of the Palace and some things that you probably did not know and maybe might have forgotten. But wide receiver Roy Williams, Rodney Stuckey, Herman Moore, Darko Milicic, what do those guys have in common? They're all hanging up in a closet in my parents' house, but there's no better gear than jerseys to wear to the game or to school. Book a warm vacation, get out of this weather, wear your Pistons jersey to the beach. Sports jerseys are expensive and have a short shelf life. The season you invest in one, you know that guy is getting traded soon. Rep the Squad is your answer for all of this. A mail-in jersey subscription service for authentic gear, not the cheap ones. It's genius, and Detroit is one of their initial markets. Switch between your favorite styles and stars whenever you'd like. Stafford's gray jersey, Slay in Honolulu blue, Andre Drummond and Reggie Jackson, and the Grant Hill teal jersey. They're all on there. New jerseys arrive fresh and clean in 2 or 3 days on your doorstep. It's like the old Netflix system for authentic jerseys. Perfect for your kids who are going to grow out of them anyways. Cancel anytime, and it's a great gift idea with gift subscriptions available. It's the perfect gift for the sports fan in your life. The promo code is LOCKED, L-O-C-K-E-D, for 2 weeks free. Again, promo code LOCKED at the website repthesquad.com. So support this podcast and enjoy this fine product and rep the squad. So we got the Chicago Bulls and the Detroit Pistons on Saturday night, kind of a throwback to some games we all remember between the Jordan Bulls and the Pistons of the yesteryear, although I'm gathering now that maybe some of the listeners might be too young to remember that, which makes me feel a little bit old, especially on the eve of my 35th birthday here tomorrow. But the Bulls, 15-27, near the bottom of the NBA and very much alive in Tankathon or Tankapalooza or whatever you want to call it. We talked about how good this draft is at the very top, and the Bulls are one of those teams that's using the high lottery advantage for some of the worst teams in the league this year as the changes in the lottery system don't come into effect until a year from now. So kind of the last year for teams to really go all after it and as far as tanking for that high draft pick this season. So, but what they do have on the court, Nico Mirotic has played really well when he has come back from his broken face after teammate Bobby Portis punched him out in the day before the season started. He's missed the last couple of games with the flu, though, so no word as of yet about whether he'll be able to play on Saturday night or not. He, of course, of the Pistons trade rumors from earlier in the week as well. Chris Dunn playing well at point guard lately, and Robin Lopez is an actual NBA player for them starting at center. They've got a Michigan State guy, Denzel Valentine, who you surely remember for the Spartans. He's starting for them lately and having a fine start to his career in year two. The big news for the Bulls is that Zach LaVine will open his career in Chicago on Saturday night. And we'll see how he is conditioned right away. This will be his season opener in the red and white and black. But the big story for the year so far has been Lauri Markkanen, the number one draft pick for the Bulls this year. He's been the big story. They dubbed him the finisher as he's from Finland, and he's been outstanding. He had 33 points and 10 rebounds in an overtime win on Wednesday night at Madison Square Garden against the New York Knicks. So a little bit of young talent, but still not a good team at all. And the Pistons coming in after knocking off Brooklyn on Wednesday night with a dominant appearance there in New York. Hopefully they can move on to another big city and take down another bad team here with the Chicago Bulls on Saturday. But by the way, wanted to mention that Andre Drummond dropped to ninth place in the All-Star Game Eastern Conference front court voting. Those were announced for the second time on Thursday. He's now behind Enes Kanter. He dropped behind him, who is now in eighth place. He's also behind Jason Tatum of the Boston Celtics. Kanter, of course, plays for the Knicks. Tatum's a nice rookie, and he's an efficient role player, but come on. I mean, as far as all-star voting, Andre Drummond deserves more of a nod over Tatum. But these are the kind of things that Detroit players haven't done well with in the past. We know our place in the you know, professional sports landscape, and it's not the kind of team and the kind of players that we have that are going to be drawing a lot of votes. So it's probably not going to be a start for Andre Drummond as the fan voting continues through Monday, and the second update came out today. But fan voting only counts for 50% of the starting players' outputs. The media panel that they appointed is 25%, and the current player voting is also 25%. But they'll be announcing the starters on January 18th, and then the reserves on January 25th. The head coaches are going to be picking the reserves, so obviously Andre will have a better chance at that. Maybe Tobias Harris still has an outside shot of landing on the Eastern Conference team. But then the highest vote getter in the starting ranks from each of the conferences will act as a captain and pick the squads with all the All-Stars thrown into a pool. Now, like as I mentioned, the fan voting only counts for 50%, but as far as fan voting, LeBron went ahead and overtook Giannis in the second release of the voting on Thursday. Giannis had, in the first release, had been leading the Eastern Conference, and Steph Curry overtook Kevin Durant, his teammate for the Golden State Warriors, who had taken the lead in the first fan voting, which was released the week prior. But Curry and Durant are still neck and neck, so we'll see how that goes. But like I said, still only 50% of the voting for those two. But later, a little bit later, we got the interview with Nathan Bierma, who's a freelance writer for projects including the Detroit Athletic Company. So I got an interesting talk about the Palace with him. But if your company is interested in men between the ages of 18 and 44, then your company should be sponsoring this podcast. Locked On Pistons is listened to by 98% men and 80% between the ages of 18 to 44. So if you want men 18 to 44, this is your spot. Plus, our rates are reasonable. So email me at Matt_Schoch, S-C-H-O-C-H, at yahoo.com to find out more.
Yes, sir!
All right, and now we're being joined by Nathan Bierma of the Twitter handle NBierma, N-B-I-E-R-M-A, his last name, and also the Twitter handle Tigers History, which we'll talk a little bit about too. Nathan is the author of an article from the Detroit Athletic Company website titled, Pistons Had to Rouse Quiet Crowds When They Opened the Palace. Now, that's a little bit different problem than they're having here at Little Caesars Arena. Nathan, why don't you tell us about the problem that they had in the late 80s opening up in Auburn Hills there?
Yeah, Matt, when they moved from the Pontiac Silverdome to the Palace of Auburn Hills in 1988, they had kind of a culture shock where the crowd at the Pontiac Silverdome was louder, it was more working class, it was a real makeshift setup at the Silverdome with bleachers, and it didn't look like a very nice place to play, but the crowd really got into it and really made it work. Of course, they drew huge numbers there. And then when they went to Auburn Hills, of course, it was nice to have their own arena and a dedicated basketball arena. But especially when you look at the courtside seats, the seats closest to the court, they really put a high price on those, and so that drew a real corporate crowd. And so their first concern was, are we going to be able to sell all these courtside seats at these high prices? And they were able to do that, but what they noticed opening night was that those fans weren't very loud, at least not as loud as the Silverdome crowd had been. And so it was an adjustment at first for them to figure out, what do? We do have sellouts, we do have paying customers, but they're not giving us the kind of energy on the floor that we were used to before.
So what did they do to kind of fix that? You got all these corporate suits down in the enjoying after the long day of work and just kind of maybe crossing their legs and enjoying a cocktail during the game. How did they fix that? How did they go about bringing that Pontiac Silverdome atmosphere up to Auburn Hills?
Yeah, so the Pistons front office had a meeting after the opening night. And I should say my article on this is based on the account given in Cameron Stoth's book, The Franchise, which is an excellent behind-the-scenes look at this season, this first season that the Pistons played at the Palace. And they had this kind of emergency meeting. The players actually complained to them, to the front office, saying this crowd just isn't going to give us good energy to feed off. And so the front office kind of put their heads together. They said, what can we do? They made certain regulations about times that you couldn't do PA announcements that would kind of interrupt or distract from the game or just kind of take the fans out of it. They had a certain playlist that was targeted to engage the fans. The famous stadium anthem, Rock and Roll Part 2, I guess hadn't quite made its impact yet. And so it was still kind of new, and they played that at the Palace, and that seemed to get the crowd into it. They had highlight reels that showed bloopers and Pistons players, you know, diving for loose balls and exciting plays that seemed to wake the crowd up. Ultimately, I mean, they had this beautiful sound system at the Palace. It was state of the art, especially compared to what they had at the Silverdome. And then one final kind of touch that the front office kind of noticed is every time the PA made a reference to the Pistons as the Bad Boys, the crowd really seemed to respond to that. Now, when you had the corporate crowd, with people based in Auburn Hills, you wouldn't think that they had naturally inherent claim to that nickname, Bad Boys, but they identified with it, and all Pistons fans of that era really came to identify with the Bad Boys and say, yeah, that's our team.
Yeah, and then I remember the posters at 7-Eleven with Rick Mahorn and Bill Laimbeer squeezing the basketballs with the Bad Boys skull and crossbones on there. Those were all over the place. And then the shirts. I still have the tank top. I wear it to the beach whenever I go to the beach, or the Bad Boys tank top. But interesting, for listeners who don't, the rock and roll part two is that Gary Glitter song where they go, na-na-na-na-na-na. Hey, so that's that one, in case you were listening to Nathan's response and didn't quite get that. But it's interesting that you note that the Palace, obviously, like you said, a basketball-specific arena, which you had some arena football and some hockey in there over the years, too. And then, but it was primarily built for basketball and then concerts, but they kind of used those acoustics to kind of solve their basketball noise problem. So kind of interesting thing, because every performer you ever hear about that talks about the Palace talked about how it was one of the better arenas to play in acoustic-wise and a good place to see a concert there. Now, one of the stories from your article that I really drew to and enjoyed was the Leon the Barber story about his interactions with others at the Palace. How did that go, and how did it go way back in the day? I think even in the Detroit days, you had an interesting anecdote about him.
Yeah, Leon the Barber was a super fan who maybe some fans from that era remember. I loved hearing his story in this book, The Franchise, which I first read, I think, back in the early 90s, maybe shortly after it came out, and I remembered this episode with Leon the Barber. I didn't remember there was a story that Cameron Stoth writes about way back, and I think it was the late 70s when Dick Vitale was coaching the Pistons in the Cobo Hall days. And Leon the Barber became this really vocal fan who would just hurl all kinds of invective towards the opponents. Some really vile stuff at times, but it made opponents rather uncomfortable.
Every home crowd needs one.
Well, then the Pistons certainly got theirs with Leon the Barber. And there was one episode at Cobo Hall when the officials heard Leon the Barber but thought it was Dick Vitale who was saying rather unpleasant things, and they threw Vitale out of the game. And so the Pistons adjusted that by saying, okay, Leon the Barber is going to be permanently planted behind the visitor's bench. Well, the problem when it came to the Palace was Leon the Barber had a great seat behind the visitor's bench, but he was surrounded by these corporate fans. He was next to a woman in a business suit. And so Cameron Stoth writes about how this Leon Bradley went to one of the Pistons execs on the concourse and said, I got a problem. I can't do my usual routine. I can't say what I'm used to saying because I'm in the midst of all these suits. And he said, well, go ahead, do it anyway. And so Bradley did, and it didn't go well. He felt awkward about it, and people were looking at him and were kind of repulsed by what he had to say. But gradually, as the crowd started to wake up in those first few games at the Palace, he got a little more comfortable and didn't stick out like a sore thumb quite as much. Really, I think the Pistons players fed off that. They fed off not just the energy of the crowd, but also having fans make the other team feel a little uncomfortable.
Leon the Barber out-mouthing Dick Vitale in the 1970s, a classic story. And maybe they should pay him back. I don't know if Leon the Barber is still with us or not, but maybe they should pay him back and let him have a chair at that barbershop that they have at Little Caesars Arena. I think that'd be the nice way to have this thing kind of go full circle there. That might be the perfect solution. But
there you go.
You mentioned the quietness of the Palace back in the day, and I want to tell my own personal story about that. Well, I guess one degree removed from personal, and that it was a hot ticket, like you mentioned. They had the crowds. It wasn't like now when you could maybe stumble upon StubHub or whatever tickets that you can get for Little Caesars Arena. But I didn't actually go to any games at the Palace for the first year. I don't really even recall. I think it might have been the second or third year that I was able to go to a Pistons home game at the Palace because the tickets were expensive and all that. But my brother, Brian, my older brother, he, part of our church group, he went to one of the, mid-season games in the first year at the Palace. And of course, I was waiting up for him to tell me all about it when he got home because that was the kind of life I had back then. But anyway, he told me that the Pistons were losing. It was a rare loss for the Bad Boys at home because they did win the title that year. But Isaiah Thomas, it was in the fourth quarter. Isaiah Thomas, I think he was sitting next to Joe Dumars on the bench, and the Pistons were, it was a game that was already in hand for the opponents, but they were playing the MC Hammer Too Legit to Quit song over the loudspeaker, like you mentioned, pumping in all the music to try to get the crowd going. And that's when my brother and his friend from the church group, they kind of got to Isaiah, and I think it was Joe's attention too, and did that hand sign that MC Hammer was doing for that song, with the put up the two and the L and the two, and then the quit and then the quit sign, and they kind of got Isaiah and Joe's attention and did that with them, and they were kind of pointing at those little white kids from the church group over there, and loved how those guys were saying it. So the fact that Isaiah Thomas pointed out my brother and kind of got the church group all excited about that was something that he would never forget about his first time at the Palace. But what I'm asking you, Nathan, is do you think that my brother kind of helped the Bad Boys to get those two titles, and he was kind of the reason that turned that thing around and got it going in the right direction?
Yeah, I think that clearly changed the course of history. That definitely helped the Pistons on their way. But that illustrates how the proximity of the players to the fans in the NBA is really distinctive. I mean, you don't get that at with the NFL at all. The field is so large, the players are far away, and they're wearing helmets. With hockey, you have the glass separating yourself from the action. And with baseball, you have the dugouts and, again, the distance to the playing field. And so the NBA really, in general, can really offer that proximity to the fans. And especially back in that era, as I said, Pistons fans really identified with this team. Those were our guys with our Detroit ethos. That maybe can't be recaptured very easily, in the sense the going to work guys did in the mid-2000s. But fans really identified with the players and really embraced them to maybe an unprecedented extent back in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, and I would say, kind of tying it into the current teams, Stan Van Gundy would like his teams to be like that, but Stan Van Gundy, the executive, hasn't really found those type of players quite yet. There's a little bit of grit, there's a little bit of defense there, but obviously you need to balance that out with some offensive players. And then, of course, it comes down to luck sometimes too. You got to have guys that are willing to come here. Detroit's not a great free agent destination. When you're drafting, you got to take the best guy that you think is out there. So it's not as easy as it seems. In some ways, Jack McCloskey and Joe Dumars, as well, they did great jobs building those teams of those two different eras. They got into a little bit of luck with some of those guys. They didn't really think Ben Wallace was going to be Ben Wallace. He was just happened to be the guy that was thrown in when they did the sign and trade when Grant Hill was going to leave town. So I think some of that stuff is a little bit overblown as far as stroke of geniuses of the front offices, but it just all kind of worked out that way in some ways. But we're talking to Nathan Bierma, a bit of a Detroit sports historian that you can find on Twitter at nbierma, N-B-I-E-R-M-A. And also at the Tigers History Twitter account that we're going to talk a little bit about. He's a freelance writer who writes for the Detroit Athletic Company website, too. I came across his work first when I heard a podcast that he did on the Detroit Sports and Entertainment.com site about a book that was written recently about the Black Legion outfit and the Tigers winning the 1935 World Series. I enjoyed that interview so much that I purchased the book right away and had it sent to my dad. And he's actually 100 pages deep already. If you know my dad, that must be a pretty interesting book if he's already rolling through it that much. But Nathan, you haven't been, I believe, yet to Little Caesars Arena, but when you get there to see a Pistons or a Red Wings game, hopefully soon, what are you looking forward to seeing from the new building?
Yeah, well, the first thing I want to see is on the concourse. I want to see some of the Red Wings statues and other memorabilia that they have. I know that they have the Olympia letters, the letters from the old Olympia, which was the Red Wings home from the late 20s into the late 70s. And the letters that once were on the outside of that arena are now on the outer wall inside the concourse. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing that and seeing the statues of the Red Wings that I saw at Joe Louis Arena. With the Pistons coming somewhat late, it was sort of built to be a Red Wings building, and then the Pistons sort of came sort of toward the end. And so there's a real question of what will they do to pay tribute to the Pistons. And so I haven't found out, or I haven't read about a lot of extensive work that they're doing to commemorate Pistons history. So I'm curious to see what, if anything, they've done along the way, how they've been able to put the Pistons stamp on the building as a whole. And then inside, I'll just be interested to see what the atmosphere is like. Certainly both the Pistons and the Red Wings have struggled with empty seats. And so what kind of energy is there in that building? Anytime you open up a big brand new building, there's kind of the awe factor of fans looking around and gawking at the building, especially at first. And we know that at least some of those empty seats are accounted for by fans who are out on the concourse enjoying all the amenities out there, even though that doesn't explain all the empty seats. And so I'm just curious, what, first of all, I want to gawk at the building, and then second of all, see what kind of energy are they able to develop inside the playing area.
Well, I've heard as of late that the Pistons crowd is getting a little bit better as time goes on. My folks were at the San Antonio game during the holidays and said it was a pretty good crowd compared to what they had heard about as far as the empty seats. And like you said, I think we talked about before, the red seats stick out like a sore thumb when people aren't in them on TV. So that obviously doesn't help the Pistons and the Red Wings in those regards. But any ideas that you have? I mean, you're the expert about what they did at the Palace. Is there anything that stands out to you about some maybe innovations that they could do, some ideas they could have? Obviously, you want to get into the community and get those groups in there with some group sales. And I'm sure, like you said, the Pistons having that late start with Little Caesars Arena kind of hurt them and put them behind a little bit there. But as time goes on, maybe they can reach some of those smaller groups as opposed to maybe the big, you know, Quicken corporations or whatever, and maybe get into the churches and things like that. But do you see any other innovations to get some fans in through the turnstiles there?
Yeah, I mean, those are good ideas. You know, when I look back to the Palace, you just can't make any direct equivalents or say, well, they can just do what they did when they opened the Palace. Because as I was reading back about this era in the late 80s, when so much of the Palace and what the Palace was doing was relatively new, it was still novel. You could still rouse a crowd with a certain anthem on a sound system. And now that formula has been followed so exactly, the PA, the playlist, the music that's played, to ear-splitting levels, and the video highlights, that some would say that the Pistons or that the Palace kind of initiated that formula, and it's been copied and almost perfected over the years, so that as I write in my article, we almost seem numb to it by now. None of that really stands out to us just in terms of a fan experience. And the other big barrier that every arena, every team is dealing with now, every entertainment event is dealing with now, is the fact that everybody is now on their phones and texting and on Twitter and Instagram, and it's hard to get people to look up and stay looking up at the floor. And so it feels like a different ball game, so to speak, in trying to get crowds to engage with an event in front of them. And I was, it was remarkable to look back just 25, 30 years. It feels so different from when they opened the Palace. But one common denominator that everybody's looking to is when you put a playoff team and ideally a championship contender on the floor, ultimately that will put people in the seats and that will get their attention. That's the most important thing that went right in the Palace, and that's the most important thing that will go right at Little Caesars Arena.
Yep, and you have the Detroit sports landscape is just hungry and thirsty for a team to step up into that spotlight as far as being our championship team. It seemed like we were blessed for many years that it was some team, or the Red Wings were always in there, and one of the other teams was rotating in as far as being a championship contender there, and that's obviously not happening right now. But I wonder, with those innovations you mentioned, not only the people at the game are distracted by their phones, but everyone's got the great TVs set up at their house, so why would you leave the HD when you can flip around and be watching other things and having your second screen Twitter up as well and be cracking wise about the game during the game? But I wonder if that's kind of the way that maybe they can innovate a little bit there. I saw the Atlanta Hawks did Tinder night last year, that they used the phones, and then you could get on the dating app and be swiping right during the game to people in the arena. So maybe you could get it to be, a little bit more of a social media type friendly thing. Maybe fans can vote on which songs are playing at timeouts and stuff like that with their phones. Or, maybe there's ways to incorporate the technology to kind of, become the trendsetter at Little Caesars Arena like they were one day in the past with the Palace. We've got another piece on Rick Mahorn on the Detroit Athletic Company website as well. We'll talk about that a little bit down the road some other day, where he got picked on the expansion draft on the parade day of the first Bad Boys title. But are there any other stories that you're working on that might be coming out soon about any of the Detroit teams that people should be watching out for?
Yeah, usually. So during the off season for DetroitAthletic.com, I usually do one Tigers piece per month, and then the other is usually about the Pistons, Red Wings, or Lions. And so the next one I want to do is about Windsor Arena across the river in Windsor, which was the first home of the Red Wings when the Olympia was being built. They played there for a season or two, and it's still standing, but it's been slated for demolition. And so I want to capture some of the memories that some local sources have in Windsor about that building. It's just remarkable to me that when, you know, the Red Wings played there in 1926-27, and the building, at least at last report, was still there. I'm just interested in all these layers of history, in some cases decades ago, well before I was around. It's just interesting how these layers of history are there when you dig for them.
I wonder what the border situation was back then. I mean, and that's the first thing that comes to mind now, is it'd be a pain in the butt to get over to a Red Wings game in Windsor now. But of course, back then it would have been whatever inconvenience it was. I'm sure it was very different in some ways, but I wonder what that situation would have been for fans that wanted to get over to Canada to see those games. But you have the popular Tigers History Twitter account. Tell me how that came about, and what fans can expect on that. There's going to be a long summer here in Detroit of probably not a whole lot of winning with the Detroit Tigers team, so a lot of time to fill reading up on some past victories. What's the Tigers History Twitter account can provide those fans?
Yeah, and I debated whether or not this is a good time to start a Tigers history feed, because if I started a few years back, I'd be more interested in the Tigers. On the other hand, people would be less interested in other great Tiger teams from the past, because we had a great Tiger team in the present. But I started about a year and a half ago, and I just do basically this day in Detroit Tigers history. So even through the off season, I talk about trades from Tigers history and birthdays. And every Throwback Thursday, I have a lot of old photos to throw out there. I just got interested. I visited the Tiger Stadium site a couple of years ago, and it was the field where Tiger Stadium was. It was just an open field, but it was kept as a baseball field by a volunteer crew called the Navin Field Grounds Crew. And as I was walking the field, I was just struck by the history, but I also realized that the only history I really knew about that field, or really had any personal experience with, was the great 84 team and the team of that era. And I didn't know that much about the 68 team. I didn't know much about Hank Greenberg, the great home run hitter in the 1930s. I didn't know that much about Ty Cobb, so I picked up the new Ty Cobb biography and was fascinated by that. And so I just wanted to educate myself about all these layers of history and everything that had happened and everyone that had played at that site where I had walked. And so it's been an education for myself. I'm not an expert historian, but I sure am learning a lot along the way. And yeah, as you know, it's not going to be the best of seasons this year or even next. But I think it's fitting as we wait for the Tigers to regroup and put together their next real contention era, that we look back and remember some of the great players and great teams of the past. This year, of course, 50th anniversary of the 1968 team, and a couple of new Hall of Famers to celebrate. So the Tigers' future is bright. The Tigers' present, not so much. But the Tigers' past, there's always good things to learn.
Yeah, maybe it'll be a summer to kind of reflect on the great times, like you mentioned, especially with Jack Morris and Alan Trammell getting into the Hall of Fame this year. And maybe Lou Whitaker might get some good news maybe next at the end of this calendar year as well. Hopefully we'll have our fingers crossed about that. But so we got the Red Wings midseason, a little surprisingly good early, struggling since then. The Tigers hitting spring training with low expectations. The Pistons kind of mired in this will they or won't they kind of season that they have here. And it sounds like the Lions got their new coach coming over from New England. Sounds like that's almost all but signed, sealed, and delivered for Patricia coming here. But is there a team that you feel better about than the others right now as far as the future? Or is it as bad as it seems from this view I have here in Chicago?
Well, you know, I'll say this. The Tigers have the clearest direction right now. They certainly have the worst fortunes out of any of the four teams, but they have the clearest direction. They know exactly where they are. Their fans know exactly where they are. And everyone knows exactly what the plan is. Now, no one knows exactly when they will be a contender again. I think they could start to be a wild card factor in, say, 2020, 3 years down the road. But there's no firm deadline on it, but everybody gets exactly what they have and what's needed. And there's a lot of exciting young prospects that they've stocked the farm system with over the past year. The other three teams, as you said, you know, it seems like the Red Wings haven't fully committed to a rebuild, even though it feels like the writing's on the wall. The Pistons, you know, one night they're beating a championship contender. The next night they can't put away a weaker team. And the Lions looked like maybe our best hope for postseason success, at least to some extent, and they came up short. Maybe new leadership will make the difference there, and not to mention offensive line and a running game, but just a couple minor details there. So it's all those other three teams have shown signs of being at least in the playoffs, if not exactly a championship contender. I feel like none of the other teams knows exactly where they are and where they stand and what exactly it will take to get where they want to go. So I guess we should be happy that at least they've shown some success and give us something to cheer for. And the worst thing would be to go through four rebuilds at the same time. But I feel like other than the Tigers, there is a lot of uncertainty.
I agree with all that sentiment. I mean, you thought for a minute there, especially early on in the season, that the Lions were that team, but then you remembered they're the Lions, so there's no way this is going to work out. I like your Tigers take that they're committed to the rebuild. It's a good thing. It's years away, but I think the move is for Tigers fans, in addition to following the Tigers history Twitter account and reading all you can about some of those past great teams, make that road trip to West Michigan. Make that road trip to Erie. Maybe get down to Lakeland. Fado, Perez, Manning, Burrows. Those are the four pitchers that you need to keep an eye on. Find out when those guys are pitching. Get into those stadiums, Toledo, those minor league stadiums that you've been meaning to check out anyway. Go drive to one of those. Fly down to Florida for one of those. Check that out. And those will be the guys to keep an eye on. And hopefully, the problem is offensively that the crop is a little thin for the Tigers right now, but you had the number one pick for this coming draft in there. It's probably going to be another pitcher that they'll add there as well. There's some pieces there. So maybe the Tigers can get something going enthusiasm wise, if not major league win wise this summer.
Yeah, that's definitely the plan. And yeah, it will take some time and not all these prospects will turn out. Some will have some setbacks when they reach the majors, but I think we're two or three seasons away from seeing the turnaround really take shape. And in the meantime, there's still some fun players to watch. I'll still be watching the games. And like I said, at least with the Tigers, you know they're going in the right direction.
Well, Nathan Bierma of Twitter account NBierma, B-I-E-R-M-A, and also of the Tigers history account. You can read his stuff on the Detroit Athletic Company website. He does the Tigers History podcast on DetroitSportsAndEntertainment.com as well. Any other places that you want to send fans to check out your work?
That's the biggest thing. Tigers History on Twitter is a good landing spot, and DetroitAthletic.com. There's lots of good stuff, several contributors that are writing pieces on all four major teams for Detroit. So that's a good place to check out.
Well, thanks for your time, Nathan. And we'll see. And let us know when you get to Little Caesars Arena and check back with us. And we'll also talk some Rick Mahorn down the road as well.
Sounds great. My pleasure, Matt. Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks again to Nathan Bierma of DetroitAthleticCompany.com for joining us for that interview. Remember to rep the squad. Go to the repthesquad.com. website for the authentic jersey subscription service that you can get through the mail. Use promo code LOCKED for 2 weeks free. Again, promo code LOCKED for 2 weeks free. That would really help support the podcast, which I know is something you want to do. And also listen to Locked On Lions with Matt Derry as the Lions continue to possibly bungle their coaching search. In the interview with Bierma that we taped a couple days before, it seemed like Patricia was pretty much a done deal. But as we've learned in the last couple days, that might not possibly be the case for the Detroit Lions kind of going forward. But we're going to come back with Monday's podcast to start up next week. We're going to be recapping the Bulls game and looking ahead to the Monday afternoon game, 12:30 start in downtown Detroit against the Charlotte Hornets. Go ahead and follow us on Locked On NBA Net for the Twitter handle for the Locked On NBA Network. Go to iTunes and give us a rate and give us a subscription as well for Locked On Pistons, and follow us on our new Facebook page at LockedOnPistons.MattShook. So thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you all soon. Have a great weekend.